This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Hi listeners, this is Brent Sutton. Welcome to the 81st episode of the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. On today's podcast, I talk with Stephen Scott about his journey with HOP during his career, what he is doing in his retirement, and his passion to grow the community of HOP and Learning Teams with his monthly HOP Happy Hour get-together, which can be found on LinkedIn. I found Stephen to be one of those unique people whose passion and desire to create change remain strong. His words of wisdom and his own experience of how HOP has developed is inspiring for all of us as we continue on our own journey. Please sit back and enjoy this episode of the pod with Stephen Scott. Well, Steve, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on. And I've been watching you on LinkedIn and you're very active. And You're one of the very few people that actually has on your LinkedIn page a recommendation from Todd himself.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you inviting me to be on your podcast.
No, that's great. And love the work that you're doing and love the work that you're trying to build the community. So look, for our audiences, let's have a little brief history about Steve.
Yeah. So let's see. 1989, I started working in an aluminum smelter. Started as an hourly operator, did that for about 10 years. During that time, right at the end of that 10-year period, I guess that smelter got bought by Alcoa. And so I ended up being part of Alcoa. And about that time, I took a job as a first line supervisor. And then ultimately I ended up as a department superintendent in that smelter. And then a couple years later, that smelter was curtailed. I did some continuous improvement work for the business for Alcoa. And then in 2008, I took a role as a continuous improvement manager for a business unit, the North American Primary Product. So I was working with 8 smelters and an alumina refinery doing continuous improvement work. And about 2009, somewhere in that time frame, I heard about this thing that in Alcoa we called human performance improvement. And we had brought Rob Fisher in to, you know, work with us on that. And it sounded interesting. So I went to the training and it just really resonated with me. So I started spending more and more time in that field. And eventually I tell people I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into the safety organization and spent the rest of my career there. So I spent about the last 9 or 10 years of my career working almost exclusively with human and organizational performance, and finished out my career the last 4 years there as the director of human performance for Alcoa Corp. So I got to, travel to all the Alcoa sites globally and help drive forward this journey we called human and organizational performance. And I retired in 2019. Now I'm doing it as an independent consultant.
Right. Yeah, I always like the word retirement. That really means I now have the choice of what I like to do.
Yeah. I don't have people telling me where to go and when to go. I have the option to say no.
Yeah, exactly. And it's always interesting about people's sort of individual HOP journeys, because it's fair to say that you've seen HOP evolve over that time.
Yeah. And it's interesting. When we first started in with HOP at Alcoa, it was heavily focused on preventing errors, right? And identifying error likely situations, using HOP tools to prevent errors from occurring. And Alcoa at that time was still very, very much under the influence of a guy named Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill had been CEO of Alcoa in the late 80s, early 90s, and was a safety fanatic and really, really drove the idea that we should be a zero harm workplace. Zero is possible. Every accident's preventable. The only acceptable outcome is zero. And that was very much the mentality in Alcoa. And so everything we did, almost everything we did in the safety arena, was focused on preventing incidents from occurring. So when we embraced HOP, it was about identifying error likely situations so that we can prevent events from occurring, right? And we were probably about 7 or 8 years into that journey when Alcoa had a string of really, really bad events. And we kind of realized that when something like that happens, you've kind of got a choice. You can keep doing the same stuff harder, or you can do something different. And we made the decision that, you know, this philosophy we've had about preventing bad things from occurring has only gotten us so far. And we kind of embraced this process of critical control management or critical risk management, which is basically, let's think about where failures are going to occur and how do we protect the worker when it does, which was a huge shift in the mindset at Alcoa. But it was very much seen as a much more practical, realistic strategy for preventing serious injuries and fatalities than just planning for zero, hoping nothing happens, right? So I think the evolution that I went through was, I still think there's some value in identifying error likely situations and doing what we can to prevent errors from occurring. But let's just accept that as humans, we're fallible. Error is normal. We're never going to eliminate it. Therefore, we need to be prepared for failures. And, you know, as Todd says, let's identify as safety as the presence of capacity so that when failures occur, there's enough slack in the system that they don't result in really tragic outcomes. And that's kind of the evolution that I've seen. I think the other thing that's evolved with me personally is we spent a lot of time and energy initially when I was with Alcoa in training workers, right? Every worker got like 8 hours of HOP training, and then we trained a bunch of workers as advocates and super advocates. And I am much more focused on working with leaders. I think it's much more impactful to the organization if you get operational leaders to understand what HOP is, really embrace it, understand what their role is in a HOP organization, and be willing to drive that and sponsor it. And so I think it's much more leader-centric the way I look at HOP today than it probably was back in the early days when I was with Alcoa.
Right, because obviously it's sort of, you know, the organization saying it's a worker problem. Let's go out and fix the worker. Yeah. Which is rather ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting to me, because I my background let me see a big organization like Alcoa literally from every level, from the shop floor level to the executive level. And you know, I think that's really helpful to me in what I do now, in that it's I probably have a better opportunity than most in putting myself in the worker's shoes. And thinking about things from the worker's perspective. And even when I'm talking to leaders, I very frequently talk about it from the worker's perspective. You know, think about what you're doing from the other side, from the worker's view. And I think that's really helpful sometimes to be able to put people in that position to think about it that way.
And it's very powerful if leaders can actually look at it through a different lens as well. Because there are many lenses. But just touching on that concept about the error thing, I mean, I don't have a problem with understanding error, because I think there's an opportunity in understanding error, because that opportunity is actually about quality. And I think that opportunity is also around operational excellence.
Yeah.
Rather than purely safety.
Right. I tell people all the time, the last job I had when I worked in a smelter was I was superintendent of a department we called the cast house, which was kind of the end of the process in a smelter. We took molten aluminum, turned it into finished ingots that we cut and packaged and sold to customers. So I dealt with a lot of quality issues in that role. And the first time I sat through Rob's training, what's going through my mind is, man, if we could reduce the number of errors we make that cause us to produce defective products and then send them to customers, is that worth a ton of time and money and energy and frustration and aggravation to the company and to me personally? And so when I talk to people about HOP today, I tend to talk about it not as a safety initiative, but as an operating philosophy. And safety is usually the first place we practice it, right? But I haven't seen anyone yet who practices HOP well in safety and doesn't do it in other areas of the business, like operational excellence and quality and reliability and efficiency and effectiveness, right? It just, if you think that way around safety, you're going to think that way around those other areas of the business.
Yeah, but I think the difference there is in safety, we see the error potential as a threat. But when I think about operational excellence and I think about quality, we see error as the opportunity.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
You know, I love that saying, fear the green, embrace the red. the opportunity is in the red, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So when someone's telling you something's not right, that's the opportunity to learn. That's the opportunity to basically do that. And look, I'm seeing that more and more with the work, particularly around the work we're doing with the 4Ds, the dumb, different, difficult, dangerous type thinking frame for workers, is that a lot of what workers are actually identifying are actually improvement processes. So simply by identifying, for instance, that we've got these forklifts going through these areas on a frequent basis, but if we moved the product from the area to another area, we could reduce those movements. A, you've got a reduction in exposure between mobile plant and people. B, you've got a reduction in carbon emissions. C, you've got a reduction in the amount of time and effort for turnaround.
Yeah.
All those things, they all go hand in hand.
And I think the most powerful part of that, you know, the way you describe it is let the workers figure out how to do it.
Well, they said, it was dumb. What?
Yeah.
Why do we put a product that is continuously being accessed the furthest away from where it needs to be?
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that I realized when I was an hourly worker and then when I went into supervision, that the workers are generally the first people to see the symptom of a problem, right?
Absolutely.
They're the first ones to see it. And usually either one of two things happens. Usually either they believe they don't have a voice to bring it up, or they tell you loud and clear about it, right? And yep. So as a leader, I think the challenge is to tap into those people that believe they don't have a voice and, you know, give them every opportunity, actively seek out, opportunities for them to tell you where there's pain points are, where their frustration is. And then to listen to the ones that are really loud about, that are happy to express their displeasure. Right.
Absolutely.
We can't treat them as whiners. They're people that have something that, you know, they see as a problem.
And the organization said, we were shocked to learn that it had been done that way for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it had been done that way for 10 years, because no one was listening.
I had, I can't tell you how many times I've been talking to someone after some type of incident, quality incident, reliability incident, safety incident. And, you hear that. Well, that's been happening forever. And how come you didn't say anything about it? Well, because the one time I did, nobody listened, or absolutely. I thought no one was going to listen, or we've been complaining about that forever and we just got tired of complaining about it. Right.
That's right. Or not involved in the solution, or not involved in the feedback, all those things. Share with us about the HOP Happy Hour. That looks great. And I'm going to be connecting in, and I've actually made a commitment to Steve for the audience that we're going to be giving away a book on that as well. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to admit, this is not an idea that's original to me. I remember somebody told me a while back that there used to be a group. I don't think it's still active, but there used to be a group on the West Coast of the U.S. that had something similar. And I thought, especially, I probably should have done it about 3 years ago when COVID started. But even, you know, as things are loosening up around COVID, I still don't get enough opportunities to connect with other people that are in the hop business, that are in the hop community, or that are just curious about hop, or that are, you know, wanting to learn more about it. And if I'm in that position and I'm retired and I have plenty of time, if I want to travel and stuff, then people that have, you know, busy jobs and busy lives are probably experiencing that even more than I am. So I thought that it would be cool just to have a get together on Zoom once a month for anybody that has any background that wants to talk about hop. And so we started it up in, I'm trying to think, August was the first one. And I think in August we had, we probably had 20 some people come on, probably about, I don't know, 12 or 14 of them actually were involved in the, you know, chatting and had their cameras on and stuff. And September only had a handful of us on. We're going to do it again in October. And, you know, as long as there's people that are interested, we'll keep doing it. I've gotten something out of it every time we've done it. And I think that some of the other people that have been on it have gotten something out of it. And I just think it's a great opportunity for us to be able to network, put faces to the names, you know, get to talk to people. And it doesn't cost me an airplane ticket or anything. It's just, you know, sit down in my basement and turn on the computer and maybe drink a beer while I'm doing it.
Absolutely. So I think so far there's about 87 people have said they're attending.
So there's a bunch of, there's a bunch of people that have accepted this time. So I've got high hopes this will be a good one.
Yeah, well, we'll keep pushing it out for you as well, because there is huge value in building community.
Yeah.
Because we're all in this together. And at the end of the day, you know, I just keep telling people there's no one right way of doing this stuff.
No.
And just as change happens in small increments that we see as a big increment when an event happens, we can also affect change in small increments as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing I love about hop is that opportunity to micro experiment.
Yeah.
With people, because it can't be any worse than it is now. I mean, I say to people, because there's always this fear that if we try something, are we going to make the place less safe? It is what it is now. Like I hear it all the time. What if we learn stuff we don't want to know about? I said, well, it's happening already.
But the fact that you prove something you don't want to know about means you learned something, right? You may have learned what I don't want to do in the future, but we have learned something, right?
Yeah. And I think, I don't know how you feel, but what I'm seeing is that there is this perception amongst leaders that if they know, they have to act. That there's a connection between knowing and then acting on it, like fixing. They believe that there's a connection between knowing and fixing.
Yeah.
And I try and say to them, look, there's actually something in between called better understanding. So if you find out about something, be curious to better understand. That better understanding process, it could lead to a self-improvement.
Right.
It doesn't actually need to lead to a fix as such. And I think we've got this mentality, and you know, down this end of the world, and in many other Commonwealth countries, when we look about our laws around safety, particularly around safety governance, the criminal offending at a what's called a border and officer level, is actually about failing to know, not failing to act.
Mm. And well, we're. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. It surprises people because they always thought, you know, our risk is if we don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
We're saying, no, the risk is actually not knowing about it.
I think you're right. I think we here in the U.S., we tend to be a very litigious society. So I don't know if it's exactly the same, but one thing I do know is that, or that I have observed in a lot of places, is that when we find a problem, very often we don't want to do anything until we found what we believe to be the perfect solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's that analysis paralysis, right? We keep looking at it and thinking about it and talking about it. And well, this will solve 50% of the problem, but what about the other 50%? And I think the one thing we encourage people to do in HOP is any incremental improvement is a step in the right direction, right? Don't look for the home run, look for, you know, get a base hit, move, just keep moving forward in the right direction. And one of the things I think that does for us is usually those incremental improvements aren't multi-million dollar capital projects. Usually they're things that are quick and easy to implement. And that means we can do them fast. You know, we can do those micro experiments, prove it out, make the change, and keep moving incrementally forward without waiting for that multi-million dollar project that's going to be, you know, the cure for everything.
Absolutely. And we have the saying when we do learning teams, we call it improve or remove. So if you affect change, has that change become embedded? Is that change sustainable? And if it's not, either improve it so it becomes that or remove it.
Yeah. Because
don't let waste build up in the system.
Right.
Well, I think waste is your biggest enemy.
Yeah. It's funny you said that. I was just dealing with a client very recently that has a very rigorous continuous improvement project that is driven by a team of engineers. Right. And what I heard from the workers over and over again is when they show up to do a continuous improvement activity, they already have their mind made up what the solution mm-hmm. is. They implement that solution regardless of what we say. And as soon as they leave, we go back to doing it the way we always did it.
Yeah.
And that's everything you don't want to do from a, you know, from an improvement perspective. And I think the absolute worst part of that is the message it gives to the workers that you don't know what you're doing. I know what you're doing better than you do, which is just a terrible thing to tell the people who do the job every day.
Look, it is. And sadly, I've seen the same thing, Steve, countless times. And I do quite a bit of work on the other part of my business is around dealing with fatal events from a legal perspective. And, you know, machinery still makes up a huge amount of these types of events going wrong. And I just keep seeing the same things happen continuously. And it all comes down workers being able to access, you know, these danger zones around machinery. Engineers have a view that it's the fault of the person wanting to do that, not the fault of the machine, because the machine is just releasing energy. The machine's doing what it's designed to do, which is release energy. And the biggest thing that I have to talk to them about is this concept called reasonable foreseeable misuse.
Hmm.
So that is, if we haven't designed the risk out at the beginning, then we're always going to be facing an uphill battle, because our best opportunity to manage risk is at the design phase. So whatever we missed out at the very beginning, we now have to deal with its potential consequence.
Yeah.
And when we put in these other mitigations or defenses or controls, we have to understand how the worker sees that through the different eyes of how they perform their normal work.
Yeah.
So whether it's for, you know, setting up the machine, calibration, operation, cleaning, you know, clearing jams, all those things happen. And surprisingly, that risk profile dramatically changes across those different modes. But no one asks the question, what does normal work look like for them?
Yeah. That's it's funny. I can remember this is years before I heard of hop. I can remember we were installing a big automated complicated piece of equipment in the department where I worked at a plant, and it was very, very evident to us that there was an unguarded machine. And when we commented about that to the manufacturer's reps that were there guarding it, we actually said, you know, OSHA is going to require that we have a guard here. And he looked at us like we were stupid. And we said, what, you don't require that? And he said, we're not dumb enough to stick our hand in there. And when I heard that story, the thing that's going through my mind is, that's because you're an engineer, not an operator. You're not the one out here running that machine. You're the guy sitting in front of a computer designing it, right?
Yeah, they think that a worker would have to be stupid to knowingly put their hand in.
And when we started looking at how many different times a day that the worker mm-hmm. had to get in that area just to do the normal work that we pay them to do, it was just mind-boggling that we actually bought this machine that that had this much exposure to it. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. Steve, it's been great catching up with you today. I look forward to connecting into the Hop Happy Hour as well.
Yeah, I look forward to having you.
Love to get you back on the podcast as well, and we can talk about some many subjects. So brilliant. Look, thank you for your time today. And
thanks for having me.
I know the audience is going to love the stories that you shared with us, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, listeners, for being part of this podcast. We'd love to hear your learnings from today or other topics you would like us to support you on. Go to www.podcastlearnings.com and be part of the Community of Practice of Learning Teams at www.learningteamscommunity.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Welcome to Safety Differently Merchandise, the premium sponsor for the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. Our curated lines of inspirational clothing, headwear, cups, stationery and more at Safety Differently Merchandise is befitting of your Safety Differently journey. I am Arthur Taylor, Chief Designer. I have spent decades on Savile Row and honored to bring my talents for all fine purveyors and devotees of HOP, Learning Teams, Safety Differently, Safety 2, and the New View. Please visit the store and purchase our fine goods at safetydifferentlymerch.com. And now, back to the show.